5 Days to the Dragon Hall by Evan Marcroft, narrated by Karen Bovenmeyer. The day before I was to begin my journey north, I rode the train down to the Needles Quarter to purchase new winter boots. I quickly found 2 ideal pairs at a canopied stall operated by a harried widow. They were identical, both of cobbled Thrunks leather, insulated with Arctic bear fur, safe for the price. One was cheaper by some 10 doubloons. When I asked the reason why, the stallkeep replied impatiently that one was flayed off the arse of a hunted animal nearly 1,000 leagues from here, while the other had been cultured in a vat here in the city of Sabbat out of low-quality croûte over a span of 20 days. She then barked at me to pick one or move along, and I, of course, chose the zoofacted product. I do not know why, weeks later, with my mission done and behind me, I fingered this moment out of all the others on the string. It was not a crossroads of any sort. The path had been chosen well before I set out along it. As soon as my companion and I stepped out of the train, I was smothered by a desert-like cold. The subcontinent of Thoriel, telling me with no meandering that it did not want me here. Like all those who still lived in this lonely place, I did not listen. Like all those, for better or worse. The debt I sought was here, somewhere, in someone's pockets. It was called The Clay, and it was the train's final stop. Rails that bound a continent together ended here in a heap of loose gravel. A strip of land like an icy crust between the sheer Survivor's Mountains and Yeghull's Bay. The clay had served as a border outpost in those days when this land was ruled by stone-jawed Viscarl kings. These days, it was a refuge for trappers, scavengers, miners, and fishermen, a place that had fought long for permanence and was slowly losing. Half town, half camp, driftwood shacks intermingled with frost-shingled log cabins and seal-hide teepees. Those that came here sought plunder and little else, and there had never been enough to make them stay. The waters here were once wormy with Arctic halung, and their leviathan bones were ingrained in the town's architecture. But with increasing frequency, the brave men that went out looking for them came back with bloodless harpoons. At midday, the clay was as bustling as it would ever get. Teams of hunters lugged mounds of pelts so fresh that they had yet bled down their shoulders. Sled dogs quarreled over bones in the street. Wives peeled vegetables and chopped wood, and wind-burnt whores beckoned unenthusiastically to me from the shelter of their doorways. Survival superseded all in the winter-bound wilds of Thoriel. Dignity, most easily. I ignored everything offered and made my way expediently toward the tallest plume of chimney smoke in sight, which tapered downward toward a trapper's saloon and inn called The Pitfall. There I inquired as to whether any could tell me the whereabouts of a houtloft called the Zubermank, or, more preferably, its captain. At the firm urging of my larger partner, I was directed to a landing field on the southwest outskirts of town. I spotted the Zaubermank immediately, for it was the only houtloft currently docked there. The zoofacted air vessel, half flesh, half artifice, had seen better days. Its captain was a pair of legs protruding from under its keel. The rest of him came wriggling out onto his haunches at the sound of my approach. He was small, but broad-shouldered. The hard core you get when you whittle all the weakness off a man. Not wrinkled by age, but corrugated. A face built around a chisel of a nose and a club of a jaw. One oil-stained hand scratched ice out of his whiskers. The other leveled a battered Kromtosser brand revolver at my chest. His small, black eyes moved from me to my companion, in whose shadow I stood. I may have been intimidated, but the auto vault did not have that capacity. The 8-foot-tall, steel-jacketed Chimera stared back at him with a face of featureless armor until he was forced to blink. "Mwale Saut?" I asked. "The Sky Hauler?" "Who the hell are you?" he demanded in reply. I offered a bow. "My name is Etlin Jaud," I replied. "I am a debt collector with the Huigshauter Collateral Recovery Agency. I can provide my license if you wish." The man said nothing, so I continued. "I must notify you that the debt you previously owed to the First Tolbiwan Bank of Blessings has been purchased by the Haythern Delinquency Company. The new owner of your debt has elected to collect in full without delay. So, I am here." From the breast of my leather jacket, I produced both my business card and letters of evidence demonstrating the lawfulness of my presence, as well as the amount to be repaid. Mwale Saut read them twice over and then balled them up in his fist. Incredulously, he growled. "You legged it all the way up the frostbit limb of Superhull to shake me down for a few drowning doubloons?" "I am a professional," I said, diplomatically, "and I should say that it is a fair sight more than a few doubloons. Please, lower your weapon, by the way. My companion is growing agitated." As if cued, the autovault dispensed a wet rumble from somewhere in its innards. A standard-issue collateral transport and bodyguard, it had been bioengineered solely to defend me, or any value stored inside of it. And it was strong enough to crush a thief against the inches-thick vault door in its chest. Mwale reluctantly holstered his pistol. "Well, you're on the mark there, lad," he muttered. "And I'll tell you what, I ain't got a penny of it. Couldn't even pay to send your arse back to the Sabbat way."
"I am prepared to accept repayment in other forms," I said.
I take an appraising look at his airship. "Everything has its value." Mwale let out a coughing guffaw. "That there's a breaking up tub of rust and piss."
"True," I admitted, "but it would be not insignificant chunk of your debt."
He spread his hands helplessly. "Fookies send me from fools. And how'd you expect me to collect the rest without a ship?" Before I could answer, he silenced me with a finger. "Listen, you," he said. "I've got the solution to your problem and mine. All I need is 5 days, all right? Give me that, and you can have my ship if you still want it." I cocked my head.
"Speak, then."
A gray tongue wet blistered lips. "Dragonhole," he said, like a wolf remarking on lambs. He stood and pointed to the north. "Came down yesterday morning. Felt it hit all the way down here. That means it's as big as a mother. You know anything about dragons, lad? You know what they're worth? I do. I spent my whole life waiting for one. You can't zoofact 'em. The technology ain't that good yet. And every part of them's good for something, better than anything else. We get to that dead beast and fill up my ship with as much of it as will fit. Blood, bone, eyes, brain. Piss! One trip will make me rich as a quartermaster, and that makes everyone happy, don't it? His eyes gleamed with greed. I'll pay him back double. What say you? I did not answer immediately. This was an atypical situation, but not unheard of. Very well, I said, but on the condition that I accompany you. It is my duty to secure payment to the best of my ability. Is that agreeable? I assure you that I am highly capable. Mawalai's brow clenched in suspicion, and I keenly felt myself appraised. I sensed that he was shrewder than his screw-alt brogue implied. "Highly capable of pain in my arse," he eventually groused, and gave me his paw to shake. With the terms decided upon, I returned to the pitfall to seek lodgings for the night. We were to shove off tomorrow at the first thread of light. There a dark-eyed youth emerged from an alley to try and sell me a gun he would not let me see. "I would need one around here," he wheedled. "'S dangerous, ye ken?" I turned him down courteously and showed him that I had one already, which sent him and his hidden friend running off. We know little of the near universe just outside our mouse-like planet and its thin envelope of atmosphere. What ecologies exist are as opaque to us as those of the aphotic pressure of the deep oceans. But we know they exist, and that dragons are not an apex predator. The intellect cowers at what might have killed such a creature. But something did. There was a bloody grappling in the trench between the world and its moons, and it lost. Dead or dying, its body must have been yanked from the jaws of its killer by the littlest finger of our world's gravity. Its fall would have been a relative apocalypse. The parasites clinging dumbly to its squeamous hide would have been incinerated as their host splashed through the atmosphere. The dragon must have seemed a downed star, flaming in undiscovered colors as its vacuum-proofed epidermis reacted with nitrogen and oxygen in a chemical rapture. And if, by some cruel miracle, it had survived that descent, burning all the while, the impact would have killed it, and absolutely everything within its blast radius. Dashed across the tundra, it would have thrown meaty particulate across leagues. I pictured winter-bound camps swamped in molten flesh, and raised a plume of dust and steam visible behind the curvature of the planet. Many who saw it fall would call it an omen, something god-lobbed. But a few would know it for what it was. Money. A centennial opportunity to get flush. A treasure corpse put on ice and just waiting for an enterprising someone to come and dig out its solid gold heart. 5 days from here was your dream come true. I was relieved the following morning to find Mawalai waiting for me and chewing on an obnoxious cud of fermented leaves. Wordlessly, he hooked a thumb over his shoulder, inviting me into the hanging belly of his ship. I had half expected the man to run off without me in the dead of night. I wanted to think he was an honorable sort, but he simply could have known I'd chase him. And so, as the morning began to hatch, we lifted off and set out with no fuss. I was acquainted right away with the Zaubermank's meager crew. Mawalai himself was primarily the navigator and mechanic, knowing best how to keep his Hautloft airborne, while Nahoy, a scarified man missing the tip of one ear, served as its helmsman and storm reader. Being Tiorni, a tropical race, he wore layers of furs to combat the cold. The ship's defense took the form of Nanij, a muscular, taciturn woman bearing the blackened forearms of a tar fellow gang member. Both were Sabatine, born and exiled, but Mawalai seemed to trust them nonetheless. I eked no more than a few curt words of greeting from two of them, which offended me not at all. My living space was a spare hammock in the cabin, with a stack of threadbare pelts and my own unwashed clothes for warmth. None of the others were any better hosted. It was far from the worst foxhole I'd ever had to hide in, however. With nothing to contribute beside the dead weight of the auto vault, I spent much of the day at a porthole watching the land rise and fall. These were not the mountains of my homeland. The Hornpile Mountains west of the city-state of Sabbat were jagged and jutting, offering safe trails only to those with the stones to look for them. The Gil Range to the south was verdant and warm, reclining on the sand with its toes in the water. These peaks, however, were dizzyingly tall and steep, worn smooth by blowing millennia, and as frigid as a watery grave. I understood why the locals had dubbed them the survivors. Their icy coats preserved bones and ruins. None who had lived among them still did. Toward sundown, Mawalai came to inform me that we would be landing soon. Last spot of civilization till ever there's at the foot of Big Chimney, he said, pointing toward the last and tallest peak in the range. Little mine in town called Crum. We dig in there for the night, fill up us this boat, and hope it'll do us done. He prodded me with a challenging look. Last chance to cut out. Thank you, I replied graciously, but you won't be rid of me so easily. As soon as we touched down on the outskirts of Crum and set the Zaubermank up with a trough of crut to sip from with its moth-like tongue, Mawalai set off for the saloon, which was the largest structure in the meager town after the administration building and infirmary. I followed at a distance. The air here at Crum was prickly with the thaumaturgic wrinkles in physics that in Sabbat were called Nix, owing to its primary industry. The storm stone they dug out of the mountains here was infused with nethic energies, and you couldn't handle it safely enough to not leave charcoal smudges on the jaws of reality. The worst I saw was a water pump endlessly spigoting out more of itself. They'd put up a little fence so no one would touch. Half the men I observed at the No One's Favorite cantina wore the stain of their labor openly. Shirtless backs resembled crumpled first drafts of people. Nicked miners sloshed beer through inverted mouths. I watched from the corner behind the fire as Mawalai capered among them like a one-legged man at a no-legged ball. He drank through 4 jars of the moonshine they brewed out of rattleweed, and once his brain was floating free in it, he ordered shots for anyone who asked, spilling more coin behind the bar than he'd sworn to me he had. The size of his debt no longer seemed so inexplicable. He drank, and he sang, and he fought, and it didn't matter to him who with. He would kiss a man's whore and then knock him flat, then lift him up and offer him a free gulp of chop. Kiss him too, why not? The little man owned the room and everyone in it, like the biggest of the children in the schoolyard, dictating to the rest what fun they were going to have next. My judgment of him was that he was loud and crude and loving and brave and conniving, a sorry friend and a wonderful enemy. Some might have described him as larger than life, but a story is shaped by the storyteller. Those qualities did not matter at all to me. I only cared for what he owed. We were 8 hours into the second day before we spotted trouble riding our shadow. Nanij, who was manning the binoculars, gave a shout that brought Mawalai and I running. "Pursuers," she said tersely, pointing at the mole growing malignant on the near horizon. Mawalai took the binoculars and glared into them. "Bastard him," he muttered, by way of explanation. "Someone from Crum, possibly. A rival sky hauler after the lion's share of the haul. Perhaps someone who had simply taken one of his mean jokes the worst way. Who knew?" Mawalai didn't think to share. It was a fight, albeit the slowest one I'd ever been in. The Zaubermank was moving at top speed, but the other ship was the stronger one and gained on us steadily. Around supper time, they began to fire upon us. For some 20 minutes, we endured a steady rainfall of living harpoons, the sort designed to gnaw through Hylong scales and swim through their blubber. They worked nearly as well on a steel hull, as we discovered when one at last found its mark and began boring towards the Hautloff's engine. I beat Mawalai in a race there and found the thing nearly through. "Kill it!" he hollered, and my eyes fell on the spade propped up by the door. A few hard strikes split it into wriggling halves. We returned to the deck in time to flinch as Nuniz shot a mortar round high into the air. Seconds later, the air around the pursuing vessel was engulfed in a gunmetal smoke. 2 more canisters, and the ship began to flag as screw-nosed nematodes ate away at its organic flight sacks. We watched the lazy crash progress until the receding Tagia took it out of sight.
"Better be the only one, 'cause that's all we got of that," Mawale grumbled bitterly. 34 doubloons a shot. Bugger me gentler, all you gods listening."
I understood that I had just borne witness to many deaths, but I couldn't fault the crew of the Zaubermank for defending themselves with no other choice. The law extends exactly as far as a policeman cares to walk. Up here, they would lose toes and ears trying. Mawalai decided to land as soon as possible, in the first patch of clear land among the increasingly sparse evergreen forest below. It was foolish to press on with the Zaubermank having an open wound, and we were losing the light anyway. Better to bunker down for the night. It was pitch black by the time repairs were finished. We took watches in pairs, and I found myself sharing one with Mawalai. We sat on a deck about a drum fire that burned nearly lightless. To pass the time and help us forget the cold, Mawalai shared stories and tall tales. This land was wolf land, tameable but unknowable. It bred fearsome critters as quick as rats, and he knew them all. There was the Yalalihu, the bird that crooked itself, but could sound like any other bird. I ought to look out for snow gulpers, which looked like ordinary snowbanks until you traipsed into their cave of teeth. And most of all, beware the Uggul, the giants that trapped men for their hides and took the souls of great caribou for their steeds. I asked which of them were real, and he said every last one, in shades. And when he grew weary of stories, he asked truth in return.
"You come from Sabbath, eh? I ain't been back there in a pack of years. What's the news? Who's the quartermaster now?"
I shrugged. "Still Brugenstamer."
"Nah, shoulda guessed. That great mean bastard."
Maybe not for long, though," I said. "There's a revolt on. Stamer the Younger wants her father's job, and the common folk have found the stones to get behind her. In fact, I had initially believed that was why my client had called Mawalai's debt. In times of political upheaval, cash in one's hand was worth more than cash in someone else's. but I suspected he had a reason more personal as well. Mwale snorted at that. Lutinous Damer, that wee girl. Nah. I peeled open a tin of beans and held it over the fire to warm it up some. She's 20 now. That seemed to electrocute him. Ugh. Mwale sighed. He slumped back against the railing, as if suddenly too heavy for himself. Time's queer up here, you know, he said, looking askance into the whistling dark. Go out, dig up something, come back, sell it. Make enough to go out again. And it's always the same damn snow. Same damn sky. He sat like that, in distracted silence, as I told him of the terrorist attack on the Isle of Old Morso, the progression of the war with the Khmem Empire in the south. The songstress, Stella Lugbasi, was touring the opera houses of Mongersley Isle. Luke Gengram, a new Tuyorni church, had gone up in Gospel Fen to replace the famous one that burned down. I ate and talked. I could not tell if he recognized any of what I described, or if to him I, too, were inventing critters from nothing. A bird made a sound off in the distance. Yalalihu, I thought, but probably not. That was quit work you did back there, Miwalai remarked a while later. You military? I chewed, swallowed. Husariat, 7th Prinsect. Ah, a policeman then, he said. Thanks for your service, Mr. Blackcoat. It's nothing. His expression turned wary. Were you hot or cold? Cold, I replied. Ah. He spoke no more after that. I think that he was no longer sure of whom he was speaking to. The difference a word can make, I supposed. The difference between doing a job in the day or the night. Mwale's mood turned sour the third day. The Dragon Hall was paradoxically too immense a hoard to possibly split with another crew. He began to spend more time on deck, glaring at the horizon, fearing almost to the point of hoping that another rival would come slinking over it. Throughout the day, we followed a river whose lips were well shaven of foliage. Among the trees below, I would now and then spot the occasional right-angled carcass of a logging camp, long deserted. Tree-clearing machines lay abandoned under rust and moss and frost, like weapons thrown down in a rote. Cleared patches of forest were scabbing over with green again. The people of Thoriel had dried up as the need for its meat did. Nearly everything it had to offer could be grown from template in a damp basement in Sabbat. We were flying over the high water mark of man's interest in this part of the world. Our ancestors had fled here 2,000 years ago, and here we were fleeing again, escaping cost inefficiency. I doubted that this time we would ever come back. Remember when this was all its own country? Mwale muttered. I was not sure at first if it was meant for me, but I was standing nearby. 20 years behind, you could make an all right living running pelts and things between here and the clay. From there they'd go everywhere. They paid big for natural fur, them fancy ladies down on Mongersley Isle. Not no more, though. Now they know there's no difference between real and something squeezed out of a vat but the cost. He bared his yellow teeth in a grin that was not a smile. He shook the railing, as if yawing on a racehorse. Dragon's still good, though. Mwale Sout had never been shy about his avarice. But this was the first I'd seen of a softer, bloodier desperation beneath it. Out of curiosity, I asked, "What will you do with your profits off it?" He repaid me with a venomous glance and spat into open air. "Pay you the price you name to screw yourself, you lamprey." We both started at a sharp yelp of pain from below deck. Not a sound one could ignore 20 fathoms in the air. Being the younger man, I beat him to the source. Down in the hold, I found Nahoy, collapsed against a croot tank, clutching his blood-soaked hand, while Nanij danced around the auto-vault with a knife. My auto-vault remained stoic, but with a tauntness in its shoulders that I knew to mean agitation. I inserted myself between the two before the auto-vault could lash out and take the woman's head off. "Your fucking monster broke my damn hand," Nahoy snarled. "Then you must have been trying to access its locker," I said. "So what if I was?" he retorted. "We got a right to know what's on this ship, am I right?" Nanij grunted her affirmative. She was a miser with her words, but I sensed a greater bond between the two of them than either with Mwalai. I hadn't missed how they shared a cabin. "Your ship," I said carefully, "belongs by law to my employer. Technically, you are guests." Nahoy cocked an eyebrow. "Oh, I? And just who hired you, anyhow? I've been meaning to inquire." I briefly considered answering forthrightly, but erred in favor of discretion. I was a professional, with high expectations to meet. "I have been contracted by the Hathern Delinquency Company." Nahoy lurched away from the wall and shoved past Nanij to stand within a finger's length of me. "Save all that shit to feed to the real fools," he sneered. "Just a business's only cares about profit. You can't tell me they honestly think that Mwale's debt is worth the expense. Ain't no fucking committee fool enough to shell out to send you and your pally there to shake us down for fucking pocket lint. There's a man, ain't there? Someone with a score to settle. So what's their name, eh? What are they really after?" "I am a professional, sir, and that information is confidential."
"Stow it! The lot of you!"
Mwalai barked. He grabbed us roughly by the shoulders and pried us apart.
"You drowned idiots think this is the time to have it out. Might as well steer us into the trees and call it an early day. Supposing you all want to see tomorrow, we can't be turning on each other, 'cause we're all we got out here. Every problem is everyone's problem, and when we got a problem, we gotta make it right. You ken?"
His was the tone a father might take with a pair of bickering sons. But I could see his point, and so did Nahoy by the way he looked at his feet. Even in this far-flung place where the world seemed to run thin on ideas, the only things we had to put between ourselves and death was one another. I gestured at Nahoy's wounded limb. "Your hand should be fine," I said. "It's your finger that's broken by the look of it. If you'll allow me, I have the relevant experience."
"I can splint it by my own self," he said.
But I saw him consider it first. I supposed that was better than nothing. Nanij sheathed her knife and walked away with Nahoy. The auto-vault lowered its hackles and resumed neutral attitude. Mwalai looked at me like he still had some yelling in him, but took his own advice and stomped away with a bullish snort. Nothing further troubled us that day, but Mwalai and the others tackled the swarming chores of maintaining a ship with skin clenched as though at any moment it might. Rising from the distance, like an inverse mountain, was a gray anvil cloud of dirty red, proof that the dragon really was there, rotting but dead, gravid with promise.